together, we're to order, hopefully here, on Tuesday, March 8th, and it is 8:05. Present are Representative Elkins, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Gardner, myself, Chair Seaton. We also are joined by Representative Guttenberg, and I see Representative Ledoux in back. If you'd like to come join us at the table, you're welcome to. And today we have four items on our agenda, and we will take HAR 8 first. That's supporting the Army National Guard, and House Grant Resolution 8 sponsor. Could you come forward?
Carl, put it in the copy. He'll be right back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be back in State Affairs. Congratulations on your new improved space. Thanks for the extra room here. My name is Terry Harvey, and I'm here from Representative Wyrock's office with House Joint Resolution 8. It's really nice to be here to present this to you. This is the legislature's record of support and recognition of the fine men and women who are now serving, actively deployed in the Army National Guard in Alaska. These are exceptional times in the Army National Guard, and there are many men and women who are actively deployed, some of which who are overseas all over the world. What we want to do is not take for granted the sacrifices these folks are making. As if we were to get up out of our seats today and get on a plane and head out of here and leave our families, our jobs, everything we know behind to serve our country. And this is an attempt, this will recognize officially from the legislature the efforts that they are making. Its language is inclusive. We're recognizing some of the troops that have been overseas and returned, the many that are out there now, and there are some that are preparing to leave as well. And we wanted to make sure that they understand that we're thinking of them. We know what they're going through as much as we can. And we want to make sure that the families understand how much we're thinking of them and recognizing how difficult this is for everyone, not just the individual Army National Guard member who might be deployed. And we have from Wasilla Major Katrina Pillow, who will be here for any technical questions and to offer support on this resolution. We would appreciate any support you can give us here today.
Okay, thank you very much. And I think I speak for all the committees in which we all support the Army National Guard and all the National Guard that do such fine work for us. And does the committee have any questions for the sponsor? So therefore, we'll go to public testimony. Is there anyone? Let's see, I think we do have Katrina Pillow online.
Yes.
Hi, Katrina. Would you identify yourself and who you are representing, and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, I am Major Katrina G. Pillow, and I'm with the Board of Directors for the Alaska Army National Guard Officers Association.
Great. Thank you very much. Did you want to testify on HR 8?
I would just like to say we definitely support this HR J 8. We think it's a very good resolution, and we definitely approve and feel that it should be passed.
Well, thank you very much, and we really appreciate the job that you and all the Guard does for us, especially in this time of active duty. So does anyone have a question for the Major? Thank you very much for offering your testimony this morning, Major.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on HAR 8? Is there anyone else online to testify on HAR 8? Representative Gardner?
I have a question for the sponsor.
Yes.
Mr. Harvey, and I've actually co-sponsored this bill, too. I applaud it in all aspects. My question is this. There are other National Guard in Alaska besides the Army that are involved in this, and I wonder if we shouldn't broaden it
there's the Air National Guard, and due to the differences in deployment, the amount of times, and the separation of the entities, when we approached this, we felt like it would be most appropriate to support the Alaska National Army National Guard in this particular resolution. Now, that is a valid question, and Representative Gruenberg on the Military and Veterans Affairs, we did discuss in that committee perhaps crafting a similar resolution for the Air National Guard in this particular session. But perhaps you can fill us in on that.
Thank you.
Representative Gruenberg, would you like to? First of all, we are responding to this question. I just want to make sure that everybody.
The answer to your question is yes.
Yes. No, I mean, I was clarifying for everybody that we're not in committee discussion yet. We're still in question.
Terry, does Representative Wyrock plan to introduce such a resolution?
At this stage, we're going to try to, I think our approach will be to work with the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee and craft legislation through that committee.
Okay, well, that's good, because I hope we do.
Thank you.
I don't see the chair of that committee today. Otherwise, I'd ask him.
Are there any other questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and committee discussion.
Do you want a motion?
Is there? Yes. A motion would be in line, unless anyone has any.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move HJR 8 from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying physical notes, if any.
That's seeing no objection. HJR 8 version F will be moved from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And so now we will move on to HB 83. And Representative Ledoux, do you want to come up front? Oh, Representative Ledoux and Representative.
Yes.
Gettenberg. Sorry, who's the sponsor?
They both are. Co-firms.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to defer to Mr. Guttenberg right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Guttenberg. Representative Ledoux and I introduced two companion bills, 83 and 84, that were combined into one bill, House Bill 83, MLV. The two bills, one of them just extended the sunset date on the Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission, and the other one added the word tsunami into it. So now it becomes House Bill 83 represents both of those bills. And what House Bill 83 seeks to do is to extend the Seismic Hazard Safety Commission. For some reason unknown to us, this administration and the previous administration did not seek to seat the members of this commission, and it's due to expire. Budget and audit, because of that purposes, simply recommends that it allow to expire because there's been no action on it. But we feel that this Hazard Safety Commission is critical to the safety and well-being of Alaska. There's nobody in the state, there's no commission or organization that seeks to do mitigation for seismic activity, earthquakes, or tsunamis. And what that means is that you've got all the emergency response groups out there that prepare and train to what to do in the event of a natural disaster, earthquake or tsunami. But nobody is in the state is actually working on ways to mitigate those damages. If you were to take some of the ceiling tiles off of this ceiling and look, you would see some of the basic things that are done for mitigation. There's this additional suspension for earthquake. But as far as building standards and codes and the way things should be built so that damage is minimized in the event of earthquakes or tsunamis or other natural disasters, there's nobody doing that. There's nobody making recommendations. This commission has no authority except simply to make recommendations in those matters, and it's composed of members, basically DNR, Military and Veterans Affairs, state agencies, from the insurance industry is very supportive of this. In my previous life as staff, I worked on this bill, and that's one of the reasons why I'm interested in, and I saw the support and investigated reasoning behind doing something like this. I mean, in most of our communities, we do feel shakes and quakes, and the water does rise and fall due to natural situations, disasters. But it's imperative that the state actually looks at things that we can do to mitigate the damage, loss of life, loss of property. And this bill seeks to just extend that, and hopefully by doing that, the administration will understand that the legislature seriously wants this looked at, wants this seated, and we want to look at things to do to prevent the loss of lives, anything that we can do. Thank you.
Thank you. And does the committee have any questions? Yes, Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Did you say or at least suggest that no one is doing anything about this?
There's no one actively working on mitigation in the state. There's other states have commissions that look at mitigation. And Mr. Kallenbach, who might be online, one of his comments in one of his emails that's probably in your packet talks about other states that do it, but there is no one in Alaska that does it.
Well, if I may,
yes, Chair. Representative Gatto.
When I was with the fire department in Anchorage, we were building fire stations, and we were building them according to a standard called essential buildings. And these were buildings that had to be standing when other buildings were falling. And they were built with chevrons in the walls, mm-hmm. and bracing and cables, many things. And they said schools would be essential buildings so that there was a place during the worst time of year when the major thing, earthquake happened or the volcano went up, that schools had to be essential buildings that had water, sewer, food preparation, generator backup, and fire stations had to be able to get fire trucks out of the doors. So, and it's not a criticism, it's just there are things, obviously somebody's thinking about this. Well, certainly in the city of Anchorage they are.
Yeah, there are national standards that say, you know, these are the things that will keep a building standing. But if you were to design a building on the Homer Spit, let's say, you would want one set of values for your foundation, for tsunami warnings. But if you were in Fairbanks, those are the same national standards. There's nobody saying that in Fairbanks you don't need tsunami protection for your foundations. You might need certain things for quakes, other things. The state now is considered one entire earthquake zone. So if you were building in Bethel, which I am told is, to my amazement, it's very safe for earthquakes, you would be building the same standard as you would be in Anchorage, in Earthquake Park. So part of it is deciding where the needs are and separating those out and allowing, there's an insurance representative, industry representative on this. So some people can't even get earthquake insurance where they should be able to. So some of those things is defining where the high-risk areas are for some things and where they're not for other things. And so those are some of the things that aren't being done. And I know in my life as in construction, I knew we did a lot of mitigation, but there's nobody defining which areas need more of one or less of another.
Just one additional comment.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Follow. Chair. And of course, I'm assuming that you're looking, as near as I can tell, you'd like to look for standards that say if you live on the floodplain near the Chena River, you need a certain set of standards that certainly wouldn't apply if you live on
Kodiak.
Boy, yeah, or someplace that's fairly mountainous, or Douglas. While they would in turn need maybe some earthquake analysis, and Homer wouldn't, or so. And is what you're saying that what we need to do is separate out specific dangers and the zones that they occupy, or simply there's more of a broad thing in this legislation?
Well,
Representative Gooden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gatto. I think those are the things that we're giving the commission the opportunity to look at. Are those things needed to be done? Is the tsunami danger on Kodiak or Dutch Harbor the same as it is in Fairbanks? I think that's a pretty simple answer. But I think one of the things I remember was that somebody in California had determined that Alaska was one earthquake zone because there was nobody in Alaska. A commission like this set up to decide that Alaska is not one earthquake zone. And same thing internally.
I would like to recognize that Representative Thomas has joined us, and if you'd like to join us at the table, we have an extra seat up here.
And me.
So appreciate you coming in. Oh, and Bob Lynn has joined us as committee member. Sorry. I was looking at the back of the room.
Look in front.
Is there any other questions for the sponsors? Okay, with that, we'll go to open public testimony. We have two people online, Rod Kolenbeck. Are you online in Fairbanks?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Yes, would you like to offer some testimony on HB 83?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Rod Kumbelik. I'm Associate Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys in the Department of Natural Resources. And members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. And I would just like to say that the Department of Natural Resources concurs with this bill and supports it as amended to extend the commission to add tsunami hazards to its purview, and additionally with the amendment out of Military and Veterans Affairs Committee to expand local government representation, because that's where the rubber really meets the road in terms of efforts to reduce these risks from earthquakes and tsunamis. Representative Guttenberg is correct that these hazards vary considerably around the state, from the highest earthquake exposure in the nation along the southern margin of the state to virtually no hazard up in the far northwestern corners of the state. And so this kind of variation needs to be taken into account to consistently and reasonably apply earthquake and tsunami mitigation standards across the state. I would certainly agree that there are efforts being applied in various construction situations around the state. The problem that I see is that there's no real coordination of efforts and policy standards to make sure that those standards are applied in a reasonable fashion across the state. And I think that that's where the expansion of local government representation on this commission will be effective, because several communities from around the state being represented will help the commission to devise policies that take into account these variations in risk. We know from the successes of similar state seismic commissions, particularly in the western part of the country, that the efforts and the policies that these commissions have recommended in the past have already shown to be very effective in reducing the losses and casualties during earthquakes in recent years. And similar success will certainly occur in Alaska. It's important to keep these issues in the public's attention, because these events happen so infrequently that it's easy to become complacent. It's easy to forget what happened during the previous event if it happened decades ago. And so it's easy to become surprised when the next big event occurs, and we really have not done as much as we possibly could do to reduce the vulnerability to those events. An executive order about 2 years ago transferred this commission administratively to the Department of Natural Resources. And so the Department of Natural Resources, in the budget of my division, Geological and Geophysical Surveys, already has money budgeted, set aside to support this committee. And that budget continues in our in the governor's request for fiscal year 06, and that's why the fiscal note shows zero impact because there's no change in the budget. The goal of this commission, I believe, as it was drafted by the sponsors, is to reduce our vulnerability to economic losses and casualties from now both earthquakes and tsunamis by maintaining the public awareness and recommending sound policies. And I believe this is a modest investment now that will certainly reap major benefits in terms of money and lives saved in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. And I just want to see a little clarification here. Much of the area of the state of Alaska did not have building codes, building inspectors, those kind of things. Now, this bill is not going to impose building codes or inspections or anything. This is simply looking at standards and recommendations so that we will get that information out to the people that are constructing their own houses and those kind of things, which is quite different in Alaska than it is in, you know, most areas of the United States where there's building codes that are in place and inspectors and those kind of things. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My understanding of this bill is that it is strictly, the commission is strictly advisory. It does not implement policy or establish policy. It simply recommends to the governor and the legislature policies and standards that that may be applied in a consistent fashion. Those may come out to be building codes or zoning ordinances, but perhaps not. A big part of this issue is simply in terms of public education, and I believe also in terms of coordination of these efforts around the state, not only in state government, but in local government and the private sector.
So those codes and things like that would all still have to be, would not be adopted by DNR, that would still be adopted by local ordinances in local areas, or in the case of commercial buildings like the fire regulations that the state fire marshal has could be included in there, but it wouldn't otherwise impact other than being informative for the citizens of the state.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. As I understand it, this there are seismic codes already in place in some local jurisdictions, but not in others. This commission, as I understand it, again, would not change that process. It would simply recommend how these kinds of policies can be applied in other areas and consistently around the state.
Good, and thank you for your testimony on the reason for the increasing from 9 to 11 members. That was a question that had also come up here, so I appreciated that clarification for involving the local government entities. It's very important. Does anyone have any questions on the committee? Have any questions for Mr. Kolenbeck? Thank you very much for your testimony, Rod. Now we'll go to Pat Davidson. Pat, did you have any testimony for us or just for questions? Okay, thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions for Ledge Legal?
LB Nay.
Oh, is it LB Nay? Is that it? Oh yeah. Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we add more members to this commission, does it change the quorum? And do we need to do something about that? Is that routinely done?
Let me look it up.
Unaware of whether we have a
I'll look it up.
Statutory quorum, and
maybe we could come back.
Representative Gutberg, do you have an answer for that, or we can come back to that if we?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure. It's my own impression that's a standard numbers of members by the size of a commission by the numbers of members.
Mr. Chair, I have an answer.
Okay, if you would defer to Representative Guttenberg.
Gruenberg.
If Guttenberg would defer to Gruenberg at this point in time.
Thank you, Guttenberg.
Thank you,
G.
Thank you, Mac. David.
This is like who's on first.
And you guys both have brown coats on.
Hey, yeah. Okay. AS 44.37.065E reads, quote, six members constitute a quorum. That was when there were nine members on the commission, so it wasn't a supermajority. It wasn't a simple majority. And through the chair, may I inquire of the sponsors of the bill? Of
yes, Representative Gruenberg.
Do the Coast Primes wish to increase that, or do you wish to just have it as a simple majority? Since you're going from 9 to 11, do you want to make a quorum above 6, or do you want to leave it at 6?
No, I think it's appropriate at 6, a supermajority. The commission has no real authority. It doesn't impose or regulate. It simply makes recommendations. So I think a simple majority is adequate.
Okay, thank you very much. And we have one more person to testify. Roger Hansen, are you online?
Yes, I'm here in Fairbanks.
Can you identify who you're representing and go ahead with your testimony, please?
Yeah, my name is Roger Hansen. I'm a research professor at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and I also hold the position of state seismologist here for Alaska. I am here to just briefly speak in support of a seismic safety commission. In my capacity here, we do a lot of work in cataloging and understanding earthquake occurrence and earthquake hazards, and I think a commission would be a very important body to aid in the development or the recommendations for mitigation of seismic hazards or seismic risk to the public. We do a lot of work with respect to products for understanding hazards for both earthquakes and tsunamis, and we develop many kinds of maps for tsunamis to understand the flooding and potential flooding in local communities, but these maps don't have any kind of land use management capability. I think a commission could increase where we don't have the ability to understand and make recommendations toward better mitigating the hazards that and the risks posed to the public from earthquakes and tsunamis.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Does anyone on the committee have any questions for Mr. Hansen in Fairbanks? Representative Gatto?
Well, I'm not sure who the question's for. I was just maybe the sponsor it would be better suited. Looking through the bill, I can't find how often the committee meets. Is there any minimum standard? And number two is, if the members are composed statewide and travel is difficult, would teleconference suffice? Or, and lastly, I didn't see a fiscal note, so I guess there's no per diem and no travel expenses, or are there?
No, there are none. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the evolution of this bill and in this legislation, previous ones, most of the members of the commission are public employees of one nature or another, who the role is built into their jobs. And in the terms of the private member from the insurance industry, it is that, and also, and they have talked over the years about their ability. They naturally meet at certain kinds of meetings where they get together, and they can teleconference is what meet as they think is necessary.
Okay, seeing no further questions there, is there anyone else in the room here that would like to testify on HB 83? Is there anyone else online for HB 83? I'll close the public hearing. And we are open for committee discussion on the bill. Is there any discussion, amendments, comments? Is there a motion for the bill?
I'll move the bill.
Representative Gruenberg?
I'll move the bill with individual recommendations.
That's CS for House Bill 83, MLV version F. is motion to move. Is there any objection to move from committee? Seeing no objections, the bill will move with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to change the order if Representative Thomas is ready for this bill. So we're going to change the order of consideration here. We're going to introduce House Bill 114. We're not planning on moving this bill today, but we'll get it on the table with some consideration. So if everybody would change their packets around to 144. And thank you for joining us, Representative Thomas.
Yes. I am fighting a little cold, so if I hack more than normal, it's why. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the Committee of State Affairs. For the record, I'm Representative Bill Thomas from District 5, and I am bringing forward to you House Bill 144, which asks for an advisory vote of the people of the state of Alaska. Shall the legislature appropriate $150 million adjusted for inflation annually from the income of the Alaska Permanent Fund that is in the earnings reserve account for a community dividend program? And why did we come up with this idea? As many of you have been listening to many of the municipalities, they are in dire straits. The state ceased a municipal dividend program years ago, which has created significant problems and health problems for our local communities. The local government is the closest to the people, and through the last several years we have been not funding and underfunding many of the projects that impact the local community, such as senior citizen tax exemptions. Recently we've been turning boat harbors over to municipalities, underfunding the ability for them to bring those up to 100%. And it is the intent of this legislation to provide a local tax relief for the residents and people in the communities, either by lowering the mill rate on your property tax or a sales tax, lowering it. Through the years, like I said, we have been transferring more and more of our services back to the local governments, costing them more and more money. I guess the bottom line is that I think that the state of Alaska, with our huge wealth, can share it a little more and help relieve the burden from the local municipalities. This plan has little or hardly any effect on your permanent fund dividend. It won't, my understanding of projections would be 10 years before you see an impact, and it's between $50 to $70 before it has an impact on the dividends. In the meantime, you may have immediate tax relief unless people decide to go build a Taj Mahal and instead of bonding, build buildings and whatever. This will use the small amount of the projected balance in the permanent fund earnings reserve accounts. And I think it's important that we try to get relief to the local municipalities. Again, this goes to the vote of the people. It's not a PMV, so let's not get it confused, and that's why I went to a fixed rate, so it's not as confusing to the people in the state of Alaska when they go into the booth and vote. So if you have any questions, I'll try to answer them. If I can't, hopefully there's somebody in the room that'll help me.
Okay, very good. Do we have questions for the sponsor? Yes, Representative Gardner, and then Goddard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the sponsor statement, it talks about each municipality would receive a $50,000 minimum base grant, and each unincorporated municipality in the unorganized borough would receive $25,000. Does that really encompass all of Alaska, the unincorporated municipality, unincorporated borough, and municipalities?
It is my understanding, yes. It'll cover every community that has anybody living in there right now. And this is the same program that was used under the old revenue sharing program, okay. Same formula and everything that was there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry.
Representative Thomas, do you mean the same formula, or do you mean the same communities for distribution? I mean, the amounts were different.
The amount, Chairman, yes, the amounts are different, but it's the same formula in distribution, and it's been used before.
Okay, fine. Representative Gatto?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We talked about this a little bit, you and I, yesterday, and I was looking on one of these pages here. In particular, I saw a lot of communities going to get $25,000, and just briefly, a short story. It happened last year. The community of Central was having trouble getting their school up to 10 students. They only had 8. And they were advertising for a family to please move to Central so we could get our school up to 10 students so we would get state funding on a minimum level. I'm going to guess that there may have been 2 or 3 families living in Central. So what we would have here is 2 or 3 families would receive a grant of $25,000, even though they don't maintain the road, they don't have a school, unless they got those 10 kids. And I'm just seeing some inherent, I don't know about the word unfairness or overextension here, to give just a few families $25,000. To do what? I'm not sure what we would be wanting them to do with this money.
Representative Gatto, through the chair, when I was reviewing the municipalities and non-organized municipalities, the smallest community that I saw that was in Alaska was 69 that was on this list, and I don't have the list here with me, but it showed 69. Mm-hmm. And again, the reason we're going with the unorganized municipalities, I feel that this is earnings of oil wealth that was given, put into the permanent fund, that was, they get equal treatment through the permanent fund dividends down, so we didn't want to stray too far from everybody participating and being eligible to share in this program.
Follow up, Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And the other thing that we talked about, for the sake of putting it on the record, where the Matsu Borough was listed with a 2004 population, it's listed here, and the population is used in the calculation. Population is listed as 57,000 some odd. The current population in Matsu is probably 70,000. I would guess that since this is listed as the 2004 population, my understanding was at the end of 2004 we were 70,000. So the concern, of course, is in the areas that I know, for instance, the population in my own community, I couldn't begin to guess of all these other ones. But it's sort of like a formula that might have some flaws in how we allocate the multipliers, which is the number of people in the community. So,
Representative Gatto, through the chair, the population calculation is the same that has been used through the years, and it's done by a state demographer in the Department of Commerce. And the indicators that they use, and the most recent ones, were used by the permit fund earning permit fund applications, federal tax filings, birth and deaths statistics, and surveys. So I can't answer your questions specifically as to the accurate count, but one of the things that we may want to point out is that this bill is just going to the people for an advisory vote whether or not they want to do it. If the people in the state of Alaska vote yes, we will be back here drawing guidelines as to how it's administrated in which ways. You'll get to an amendment that's on the floor also, potential amendment.
And Representative Thomas, this is not set up so that this goes with a certain year-based population. This would be adjusted every year that the population increases or decreases, whatever is determined. I mean, whether it's January 1st of the year or December 1st, December 31st, I mean, of the next year is really going to be kind of immaterial, because in the following year you would pick up the changes over that next year. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, Chairman Seaton. That's what we intend to do.
Yes. Fine. Representative Lynn had a question.
Yes, I have a question, and I have an amendment I'd like to offer, but I want to ask the question first and amendment at the time of your choosing.
Right, and what I would like to do is get through the public, go ahead with the questions, and then we'll go through the public testimony, and then when we come to committee discussion, we'll offer the amendments.
Thank you. The amendment pertains to property tax relief, but the question is, you know, people are very, very concerned about losing any portion of the PFD, you know, 10 cents, you know, whatever. And I know you touched on this during your opening comments, but I'd like to have you put it on the record again. How much would that be taking out of the PFD, would you imagine, between now and the first 10 years?
Representative Lynn.
How much money are people going to lose?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, my understanding that there'll be no impact on the permit fund check for 10 years. And after the 10-year period, it'll be up about $70. In the meantime, if you were to take this $150 million and go backwards, I believe it's around $200 to $300 potential impact to them at the local level, if it's used to relieve them of property tax or a sales tax of some sort. But you'd have to compute the dollars backwards from this $150 million.
Thank you. I just wanted to put that on the record, Mr. Chairman, so anybody listening to this testimony might be reassured.
Thank you, Representative Lynn, and we'll request from the permanent fund that information as well, because they'll be able to project that out.
Thank you.
We have dollar amounts there. let's see, Representative Elkins, did you have a question?
No, I don't know. Thanks.
Okay. Anyone else have
yes.
a question for the sponsors? Yes, Representative Grunberg, you're next on the list.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Thomas, the term community, I can't find defined anywhere in the Alaska Code, and I don't see a definition of community in this bill. Do you plan to put one in? This kind of gets back to Representative Gatto's question about CIRCLE.
Oh, a community dividend? I see that in the... Well, I don't know if there's some people here from the department, if they have a definition that's used within the department.
You don't have to answer that. Just something to make
okay.
a note of.
No, Representative Grunberg, through the chair, what we're trying to do is try to make sure that everybody who is entitled to a dividend gets one, whether you're an organized or unorganized municipality. I think that they all should share in the wealth of the state of Alaska, and that's why we're going this way. But we will get the definition for community for you.
Yeah, I understand that because my recollection is that at the time of the Claims Act, people reestablished long-standing communities so that they could participate in that. And as a result, a number of, I don't know how many, communities were reformed. And here, of course, it's not the same thing. It's not based on long-standing tradition. But I could see smart people in the bush getting together to get themselves some money.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, hopefully the department who administrates this will be smart enough and shrewd enough to figure that out. No doubt there'll be new communities growing as you see those mineral and oil development going around the state. So you can look at several mines. If they're not located near a municipality, no doubt there'll be a new one growing up there. So hopefully the department will have the discretion and ability to decipher.
Through the chair, it would be kind of an unusual animal here. It's not a referendum, it's an advisory vote. And then it would be up to the legislature to implement it. It wouldn't be just directly to a department. I think the legislature would look at it almost as though it were establishing some kind of a following through with an initiative, because people would basically be voting on a distribution from the permanent fund. And my recommendation, very respectfully, would be that a term like that should be defined actually in the bill itself, so people knew what they were voting on, and so future legislatures would have some guidance on that. But that's something that's up to you.
Okay, Representative Grunberg, through the chair, is my understanding once this advisory vote is passed by the people, we do come back to the Alaska State Legislature for a bill as how to administrate this program or this grant. Then we'll probably answer some of the concerns that other people have here. especially in when it comes to size of municipalities.
Representative Thomas, I had a couple of questions. One is that although this is an advisory vote, you know, normally in appropriations or allowing assessments and then reappropriating those assessments to pay for a particular use, we use up to a certain amount, and this says $150,000. And so I'm wondering if under this, the way we've got it, there would be an expectation by the people voting that it will be, I mean, $150 million, that it will be $150 million. And if there's not the money after, in the earnings reserve, after inflation proofing and after paying the dividend, that we get into the conundrum of saying, now where do we go? Do we pay nothing because we don't have the $150 million, or do we pay, or have we violated a promise we've made to people because they voted in favor of this $150 million instead of the legislature may appropriate up to $150
million? This, Chairman Seaton, is, again, it's my understanding that when if this is passed by the people, we come back to write the bill, and if you don't have the money, definitely you won't be able to appropriate it. So these will be guidelines, again, set out in the next bill as to what percentage then can you make to the municipalities. But if there are no earnings, there's no money to give. That's, you know, and I think that the municipalities have to be very careful that they don't spend any which may be considered windfall without really considering what they're doing. I think we've put them in a corner, and we're trying to help them out of the corner, and hopefully they don't paint themselves in that box and corner there.
Right, and appreciate that. And I'm just, you know, wanting the sponsors to think about possibly adding up to $150 million, because that's the normal language that we use, is that we may appropriate. Because otherwise, what I'm worried about is going out to a vote of the people, and we tell them this is the amount, and there is created a legislative expectation then in there, the vote of the people, that that is going to be the amount. And if there was a case in which we didn't have the $150 million to do, then all of a sudden we are into the expectations. If people knew that it would be up to $150 million, or if it's going to be that amount. So I'm just throwing that out for the between now and the next hearing. Maybe you can, the sponsors can think about that. The other question on the bill that I had is on line 13, you have adjusted for inflation, the $150 million adjusted for inflation. And I'm concerned about putting that out to the voters to vote that, depending on what that inflation rate is, they could be saying, well, gee, we've had 10% inflation rate, this is what we voted on, and now, you know, you're not doing it. So what's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's my thoughts are mixed. I could live with it the way without it. I mean, but I think if we put it in there, again, realizing that the permanent fund earnings belongs to the people in the state of Alaska, if they want to make sure they get a 3% inflation adjustment, I think we should live with that and let them. Again, it's to provide relief at the local level. And if they agree and vote in the affirmative to have the community dividend, I think it would be a good language to stay in there, knowing that, you know, if we don't inflation-proof this, the taxes will definitely go back up on the rise, and again, hurting the people that we're trying to help now. So I could live with it, but I prefer to keep it in the language if we could, because, again, I know that most people don't like the language of inflation-proofing, but I believe in this case that it's a needed one, because we know that the communities, as they grow, need more money. And the value, of course, goes down.
And of course, we're not improving the permanent inflation proofing the permanent fund dividends. We're just inflation proofing the principle of the dividend, but not the dividend itself. And we would be inflation proofing the community section, although we're not inflation proofing the dividend. And I'm just throwing that out there for consideration as we go along, but I'm not.
Chairman Seaton, I think it's a good comment, and I think, you know, between now and the next time we have the hearings, we'll probably have people telling us where we should be going.
Sure. And Representative Gatto had a question.
I hope it's my last one. But it goes along this line. I would thank you. Currently, the permanent fund dividend is appropriated as so many dollars per person, per man, woman, and child. It's an equal amount for every person. This dividend would be an unequal amount, even though it's using the same permanent fund dividend and permanent fund, essentially, that we started with. There is some inherent inequality in distributing a dividend that's different for each person as opposed to our traditional role in distributing the dividend, and that's one of the issues that I have.
Representative Gatto, through the chair, I guess any way you look at it, even under the old municipal aid grant was unequal because all wealth comes from oil right now, and I believe everybody in Alaska should have an equal earnings and that or share of that. And so I think that in the past they've already showed not using the word bad, but discriminatory reasons before. And all we're trying to do is continue to follow the same trend that they've used. I think when you pump oil out and it belongs to the resources, all resources belong to the people of Alaska, that they've done that in the past. And I'm not saying they should continue to do it, but we're just trying to put a plan here that will be, again, help the local municipalities out.
And I think that one other question that arises on that is municipalities are a subdivision of the state and local governments, and I'm not arguing against it, but we should be prepared to talk about municipalities and then non-municipalities, because what we're saying is you do not need to be a municipality or a subdivision of the state to qualify for the municipal or the community dividend. And that'll just be an issue that people want to talk about. Representative Lynn, did you have a question?
No, I don't.
Does anyone else have a question on the sponsor? If you'll be able to remain, we appreciate it.
Okay,
thank you. There may be some more comments after the public testimony.
Okay, I thank the committee for hearing this. I'll be.
So let's go. We'll open public hearing. John Bowling, are you there from Craig?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
We sure can. Would you identify yourself?
Yes, sir. My name is John Bowling. I'm the city administrator for the city of Craig, and thank you for hearing my testimony this morning. I'm here to testify or speak in favor of, in general, of House Bill 144. As you know, Mr. Chairman, there no longer exists a revenue sharing or municipal assistance program in the state of Alaska, and HB 144 would essentially recreate the program using funds from the earnings reserve account. This proposal would not negatively affect the permanent fund dividends, at least not Representative Thomas has testified until 10 years or so, nor would it change the very important inflation-proofing efforts for the permanent fund. I can tell you as a community representative that cities across Alaska, Mr. Chairman, would be grateful to the committee and the legislature should this bill be passed. Our own community has responded to reduced sales and property taxes by eliminating full-time staff here at the city. Today, Craig has reduced its full-time staff by about 10% over the last 24 months due to lagging revenues, especially from reductions in our property tax receipts because property values in Craig have dropped noticeably over the last 3 years. Reinstating the municipal assistance, or in this case, creating a community dividend program, would be enormous financial help to our communities. And what's more, as you know, the bill provides for a statewide vote in the matter, allowing the public to ultimately decide on the merits of this important program. Mr. Chairman, thank you for listening this morning.
Thank you very much. Does anyone in the committee have a question? Representative Gatto has a question, John.
Yes, sir.
John, just trying to check something. We have some numbers here for the community of Craig. What is the population at Craig?
I believe, through the chair, I believe our current population, according to the Department of Commerce, is 1,127.
Thank you.
Okay, and Representative Ramos has a question as well.
Sir, what kind of cuts did you make in the last 24 months? Sounds good to me to cut government by 10%. I'm pretty much in favor of cutting government. Can you tell us what precisely happened?
Yes, I can. We eliminated one position here at City Hall and spread that work among the other staff. I've eliminated one position at the Public Works Department. We promoted the foreman to the public works director position after that position became vacant, and now we're holding the foreman position empty. And we recently eliminated one officer's position at the police department that's vacant right now because of a retirement. So we're adjusting to that. We're adjusting to this loss of revenue by eliminating these full-time positions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you know, those are difficult to do, but yeah, the alternative is raising taxes. At this point, our council would rather try to belt tighten on the personnel standpoint. That's going to mean some reduction in services, but we're going to have to learn how to accommodate that.
And Ron, how many, or John, how many police officers does Craig have then currently?
Four.
Four. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
We'll go to Jack Shea.
Good morning. Am I coming through okay?
Loud and clear. We'll adjust the volume down. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, because when I talked to the operator, she said I wasn't coming through too well. Anyway, good morning, Mr. Chairman, and my best greetings to Representative Elkins. And ladies and gentlemen, I represent the Ketchikan Gateway Borough as an assemblyman, and I also represent the Alaska Municipal League. I'm on the board there. I've been the past president of the Municipal League, and we are extremely in favor of sending this advisory vote to the people, especially when they can understand what the impact on their local tax situation is going to be. What this bill does essentially is replace some of the former municipal aid programs, which have already been alluded to. As a matter of fact, here in our borough and city of Ketchikan, in 18 years ago, or it's going on 19 now, we received somewhat over $4 million in state aid. And this is not unusual. This is afforded to every municipality in virtually every state in the union. A little over $4 million, which today would be around $6 million. Well, all this legislation would do if passed after the advisory vote would be to restore, in our case, about half of what we have lost over the last 18 to 19 years. We went down from over $4 million to just a few hundred thousand this last year. And as Mr. Bowling testified, this has put a real crunch on our local governments. We've also cut, and I approve of that, too. I say, yes, we need to be more lean and efficient. Well, we've cut over 90% of received a cut of over 90% in our state aid, closer to 95. And what this would do is afford local tax relief. For one thing, you need to understand that the permanent fund, of course, is taxed by the federal government. If this legislation comes to fruition and this dividend program is adopted, it means the local taxpayer will not pay 1 cent for a local tax relief, which would be in the realms of hundreds of dollars annually, would not pay 1 cent until the year 2010. And then there would be a $10, according to the permanent fund, this is figures I got from the Permanent Fund Corporation, there would be a reduction of approximately $10, and then growing until the year 2015, and it would be about $50 at that point. In other words, during the next 15 or next 10 years or so, for a cost of approximately $170, the local taxpayer would get a relief of over $2,000 in less taxes. So this is an important factor to consider. I know that it's going to be hard to pass this because people say, you know, fool with my permanent fund a dime's worth, and I won't vote for it. Nevertheless, if they realize that they will save money both in federal taxes and in local taxes, it should make it much more palatable. When it comes to the communities who might scheme to get this money or who otherwise would artfully maneuver the procedure, well, that wasn't apparent in the old formulas and in the old distribution of the state monies for municipal aid and safe communities and so forth and so on. And so I think based on the fact that individuals and families will get tax relief both on the federal side and the state side, and will not cost a tremendous amount out of their permanent fund dividend, even though that might be a hard sell, as someone has pointed out. I think this is excellent legislation, and I think you should go ahead and move it out of committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Does anyone have a question for Jack? Representative Gatto.
Jack, quick question. The population of Ketchikan and the population of the Gateway Borough, if you know them.
Yes, sir. According to the statistics I have from the Permanent Fund Corporation, which are based on community and economic development. The Ketchikan City is 7,691, and the Ketchikan Gateway Borough is 4,948 for a total of 12,639. I think we're a little bit more than that, but those are the figures that are currently in place. We've lost population since our pump will shut down. We're working hard to replace them. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. Thank you for your testimony. We have Tom Boedeker in Soldotna.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, can you hear me okay?
We sure can. We'll turn the volume down and go ahead.
Okay. I'm the city manager in Soldotna. This is Tom Boedeker, and I'm also the legislative committee chair for the Alaska Municipal League. I would generally support your efforts, the efforts of this bill to move toward a community dividend. I think other speakers have addressed a number of the reasons for that, but I have a couple of comments that I want to make about going for advisory votes. I think that there needs to be more detail on advisory votes, enough detail so that the voters know exactly what they're voting on, but you have to be careful not to have too much detail that looks like it's locking people in, or they may say, I support a program, but not with that specific feature. And I think a couple of them that I would caution you to look at very carefully is one that's been mentioned earlier, the inflation-proofing language. I think there are many people that might support a program, but not if there's a locked, guaranteed inflation-proofing. I think they view that maybe should be left to legislative discretion. And the same comment would be that I think you might have too much detail. Once again, when you say, shall the legislature appropriate $150 million annually, that sounds like a fixed amount, and I think a lot of people might be concerned with that because the public often doesn't recognize the discretion of the legislature to appropriate lesser amounts. This looks like a mandate to do $150 million, and I think that people might react to that rather than looking at the overall concept and its appropriateness in the context of funding local government. So with that, that ends my comments there. Once again, I generally support the idea of getting this out to the people, but I do have a couple of cautions there. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And we have Kevin Ritchie in the audience.
Good morning. Thank you. Kevin Ritchie with the Alaska Municipal League. And again, we have a letter in the packet. I think the challenge we have looking ahead to an election is, before I start, Representative Gatto, I was consulting with Representative Thomas's staff, and I think if you add up the Mat-Su Borough plus Palmer plus Wasilla plus Houston, that will probably be the total you're looking for. So I think what they did was they took out some of the population from Mat-Su so you don't double
count.
Yeah. But, you know, we're obviously thinking about, the election and, bringing this to a vote of the people. And several years ago, there was a tax cap campaign, and it would have basically disallowed any municipality in the state from charging basically over 10 mils of property tax to support schools and so on. And when that effort started, polls said about two-thirds of the people thought limiting taxes was a really good idea. The Municipal League was very instrumental in getting together a coalition, and there was a great coalition of people across the state, schools, chambers of commerce, business organizations, and so on, that really saw the downside of municipal governments not being able to raise money necessary to run their operations. And the vote ended in 3 out of 4 Alaskans saying that's not a good idea. We don't want to make that limit because we want to be able to provide the kinds of services that we need in our own community and have the freedom to do so. So a great example of true local government in action, in that local government is, as many people have said, the Constitution says, government closest to the people. So, I think there's a great opportunity for local government discussion and people really talking about the kind of taxes, the kind of services that they want in their communities. I think in Craig, which is one of the larger small communities, you see things like reducing police officers. We now have a number of cities throughout the state that have no public safety whatsoever unless a trooper can get out at some point. I mean, they've had to let go of their entire police protection. We have, right now, for example, at least 10 cities that have no insurance coverage whatsoever. They can't afford it. They don't have the local revenue to pay for it, even if they wanted to. And so they're basically going bare. But then again, that liability really affects everybody in the state. Likely, if you're in the unorganized borough, there was a huge loss in a local municipality that had no assets and had no insurance, that ultimately that would be a state issue. So anyway, given all that background, we think there's a great possibility to really have a wonderful conversation with the people of Alaska. The deal itself, the community dividend, is basically approximately 4 mils of property tax relief across the board for every community in the state, putting money into local government. And frankly, it might be used to help local contributions to schools, it might rebuild the police force, or it might be straight tax relief. You know, so there's all different options that have to be open for communities. But given that, this basically is the equivalent of 4 mils of property tax relief to every community in the state, and there's no cost until 2010, several years down the road, and then that cost is far, far less than the tax relief that will be received every year, according to the permanent fund calculations. We think that conversation is worth having with the public. The other point that Jack Shea made is that when we tax people, the money they get to pay those taxes is already taxed by the federal government. Even the permanent fund dividend is taxed by the federal government, and likely 20 to 30% of that amount goes directly to the feds. By providing direct tax relief to communities through this process, none of that money is taxed. And so, for example, if I were to give each one of you $1,000 and then you went and paid higher local taxes, your $1,000 would be reduced to, say, $700 by the federal government, and then you would pay taxes out of that. But local tax relief directly to the local government bypasses that process. So that's one of the great savings in here. And I think Alaskans, again, would be real excited about not paying more federal taxes to provide the services that they need at home. So given all that, we think there is real meat here to have a public discussion. We need some time, obviously, to talk to municipalities, school districts, other organizations to see if they want to buy on. As Tom Bedeker, the chair of our Ledge Committee, said, getting the specifics down is real important for the public because they're going to want to know exactly what this bill means. And, of course, to get people in a coalition to really support this, we also need some assurance from the legislature that the program will actually happen approximately as stated in the advisory vote. So that commitment needs to be there. And actually, hopefully, legislators would either be neutral or supportive of this when it becomes a discussion item before the public. You know, so that coalition building needs to happen with local government, with the legislature itself, and with a lot of other organizations. And as this winds its way through the process, that's really the question before final adoption is, can we get the quality of support behind this that's going to really create a good conversation with the public? But with that, I want to thank you all very much for hearing this, and we're certainly willing to work with this bill.
Thanks, Kevin, and I'm sure you will be contacting your municipalities. And what I would like, hopefully you could do for us, is look at, I mean, we've talked about this as municipal revenue sharing, and I'm concerned that we have two different things here. One is municipal revenue sharing, which is to subdivisions of the state, and community revenue sharing, which is much more broad. And I don't know if that's a discussion that Alaska Municipal League can have, but we're going to need to have it here. And so your organization's directed input on that would be helpful. And we're going to also ask Department of Commerce and Economic Development to give us their input on how that distribution to non-governmental communities flows and how that fits within all the context. So I'm not asking you off the cuff to do that now, but in your conversations with municipalities, would you please bring that up? Because if it comes out that we do this, we have a community dividend vote, like you say, and then all of a sudden the communities are not on board with, or the municipalities, which represent the majority of the people in the state, are not comfortable with the language that comes out, we could have problems. So that's just for the next hearing. Does anyone else have a question? Representative Gatto and Representative Framras.
Thanks, next. Mr. Chair. Do we know what a community is?
Through the chair, that's pretty much, I think, in line with the question that Representative Seaton asked, or Chairman Seaton. There is a definition right now in the old revenue sharing of what a community is, and that definition could get transferred over, for example. I think the question that Representative Seaton asked is really a broad one, is how do we provide services to unorganized parts of the state, and how do we do it equitably? The small towns that exist there right now, they try hard. Most of them have a sales tax. Most of them literally can't have a property tax because they don't have enough taxable property to really make that effort worthwhile. And when they do charge a sales tax, one example that I think I can pull off the top of my head is Ambler. Ambler has a 3% sales tax, and they get $7,500 per 1% of sales tax because these little towns aren't thriving commercial centers. So some base of support is absolutely necessary to have, to buy insurance, have a modicum of public safety, maybe support a village public safety officer, one for a whole community working, you know, that obviously can't get 24-hour coverage, but in case of emergencies, you've got somebody there to help and so on. Some base of funding is required. If not through this type of program, you basically will have virtually no services in the unorganized rural. People will get none, which is a problem for a small community. If you can't get somebody to an airport if there's a medical emergency because there's nobody to plow the roads, for example, those types of things. So something needs to be there, not necessarily this bill, but not necessarily a community dividend, but something around this minimum to keep people really having some level of services in the unorganized borough.
And some of this relates to both your and my question, Representative Gatto, and that is the question of municipal, you know, they levy a sales tax, they have to be incorporated, they are some kind of a governmental agency. Between that and a non-organized or non-governmental agency, you know, without having authority, and we just need to have that discussion from them. And I do want to quickly, if we can, get through this. We are holding this bill. Representative Ramos has a question, and I'm not meaning to rush you. We do want to introduce Representative Lynn's amendment that's on the table. I don't want to take action on that, but I want to get it introduced so that people can be thinking about it. Representative Ramos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I read Wally Higgle's book, Crisis in the Commons, The Alaska Solution, so I'm familiar with this. But to some extent, I do feel like I'm being asked to buy a sofa and save 50% by buying it now. I see it only costs us $170 each over the next 10 years, but if the $150 million were to stay in there over 10 years and enjoy the appreciation in the fund, can you also provide us what that figure would be? $150 million for 10 years that stayed in the fund, with compound interest, would that be worth $2.5 billion, $3 billion, more than $3 billion with the magic of compounding? Curious about that figure also so that I get a balanced picture and not one that just simply favors the community dividend. I'd like to know what the opportunity cost is of pursuing this, that the fund would have $3 billion less in the earnings reserve account at the end of 10 years, just so I get a fairer picture of this.
And Representative Ramos, what I'd like to do is not have Alaska Municipal League address that for us, but have the permanent fund address that. Yeah, they can do it in charts and writing for us, so we'll have time to analyze it. But let's make sure that we have that question down for the permanent fund for the next hearing on this bill. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question. It's not directly related to this bill, but I'm sort of curious about the revenue sharing to municipalities that are really small, or communities, so we say. I'm looking at the city of Anvik, and this is actually the municipal officials directory. And it says the population of 108, they have no sales tax, no property tax, no special taxes, and yet there are 11 city employees listed. So how would a community like that, how does this happen?
If you want to address that, you may.
No,
but please keep it short. We have another bill here that we want to get on to.
Okay, I'll be really happy to try. Again, not much commerce going on in these small communities, and literally no ability to really have a property tax because of all the native allotment land and federal land and so on, and actually not big houses either. Very little ability for that, probably some ability for sales tax if there happens to be a store in the town. What normally happens is they get a small amount of money from the federal government called a payment in lieu of taxes. And when there's federal land, I mean, the federal land that the federal government does not pay property taxes on, they provide about a $15 million payment that's spread throughout the boroughs and then the organized cities within the unorganized borough. Not a lot of money, but I'm guessing that what happens in these small towns is because they have so little commerce, the money that they get to support their services comes from washateria fees, utility fees, bingo, and some other creative ways of raising money if your tax base is very, very low.
And Kevin, I'm going to say that we will have DCED here next time to answer a lot of these questions instead of the municipal league. And I'd like to move on at this point in time. Kevin, are you available for questions from members?
Always.
If they have? Okay. And so we'll get maybe some written questions to you. So the Representative
Gruenberg.
Okay. Well, I mean, I have two. This is a very interesting bill. We have two questions waiting in the wings here. And go ahead with your question for the last minute. Go ahead.
And then I'm looking in the statutes here, Mr. Ritchie. Where is the statute for the definition of community and the revenue sharing? I can't even find revenue sharing in here.
Through the chair, we can't either.
Good.
But, no, I'm sorry.
Get that to me later. We'll
no, but there actually is. It's in Title 29 under municipal programs, I believe, and it's towards the end. But okay. We can get that information to you right after the hearing.
Appreciate that. Representative Gatto.
Oh, just a comment. There's always a school, and so as far as jobs are concerned, there's bound to be a few employees that are paid because of the money that follows the students.
Right.
Representative Elkins.
I think somebody in the back of the room wanted to answer that question.
Well, I think we're going to have questions come up here later. We'll have those at the next hearing. We can't. We have one amendment on our table here.
Thank you.
To be introduced. Representative Lynn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would move Amendment 1 to HB 144.
And I'll object.
All right. One of the major concerns everybody had, I make a lot of telephone calls back to the community, my own district and other, talk to a lot of people, and people are very, very concerned about the property tax situation, probably at the top of their list. People are becoming property poorer, especially those on fixed incomes. And regardless of what happens to this HB 144, I think we need to do right at the beginning, put something in here to ensure that at least some of whatever community dividend we might have would go to relieve property taxes. And in that line, I would ask that on page 2, line 4, after the word community, you delete the period, add a comma, and then add the phrase, except that no less than 50% of such community dividend shall be used to lower residential property taxes. And I had discussed this last evening with the sponsor of the bill, Representative Thomas, and we had a good discussion about this. But I think this would not only be a good idea, I think it would help, quote, sell the bill to the voters on the advisory vote. We must provide property tax relief for our residential owners.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. And since I objected, I would just note that, you know, we have a number of communities that don't have personal property tax, and in that case, I don't know whether they wouldn't get the dividend. We'll consider this. We'll think about that resolution and bring it up at the next hearing. We're going.
And if I might just tack on it, I discussed that with Representative Thomas last night, and I was going to add or to what we had, or to relieve sales taxes and so on. And I believe he suggested we just leave it to residential property taxes. But I think we need to discuss this.
Yes, we do. We will discuss it at the next hearing, and so we'll put 144 at the bottom of our list and get to the House Bill 94. And if Laura Glazer is here.
She was a minute ago. She was
a little bit ago.
Okay, we'll take a brief at ease.
Can we take it?
Meeting of House State Affairs Committee and invite Laura Glazer, the Director of Division of Elections, back to help us with this bill and the amendment package that you have before you. And we also have the committee substitute.
Just to keep this.
State Affairs and did we adopt it? See ya.
We didn't adopt the Y one now.
Why, okay. Yeah.
Do I have a motion to adopt the Y version of the... Sure. Yeah,
I'm going to object.
Okay, we have an objection to adoption of the Y version.
I need to find it.
Bill 94.
excuse me, Mr. Chair. Peter, I don't seem to have a copy of that here. Okay. I apologize.
The Y version?
Yeah.
Here. In your...
I know, I had it.
Do you want to just...
Well, I just would like to know, since it's been a long time since we've had this, what is the difference between the F version and the Y version?
You want me to tell you?
Ms. Glazer, did you say you could lead us through that?
within the time allotted.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Laura Glazer, Director, Division of Elections.
Another copy of Y.
Y has all the good stuff F had, and then on page 7, line 8, it's due to the witnessing requirements for absentee or voter registration, the U.S. citizen was removed. That is on page 7, line 8, and also on page 8, line 5. That was the amendment the Representative Ramos and Representative Ledoux worked on. Those are included in Y. On page 9, all towards the bottom there in section 17, is Representative Samuel's amendments. That carries over onto page 10 and then again on page 11. And then on the very towards the back, page 23.
Excuse me.
Oh. Laura. Sorry, what were the Samuels amendments about?
Yeah, was that the Samuels amendments, was that the ones that were adopted?
Age, yes, that was the one that was adopted regarding the candidate's age when elected. The language says if the candidacy is for the office of state representative that the candidate will be at least 21 years of age.
Okay, and for the committee's information, the other one that we were considering from Representative Samuels has been withdrawn or is not proceeding.
Okay. And then on page 23, line 19, the chairman asked that the word first be removed on line 19. On or before May 31st of the election year is the way it now reads, and it used to say the first election year, and that was confusing. So those are the changes that are incorporated into version Y.
Great, thank you. Does anyone have any questions about any of the changes in Y?
I will remove my objection.
Okay, the objection is removed, so now we have version Y before us. We also have an amendment package that everybody should have the same amendment package. I think about a half inch, a quarter inch thick on your desk.
I object.
We're going to take these in order unless we get to one where we decide to put it on hold while we go forward. So, Representative Gruenberg, the first amendment is offered by you. Would you like to offer that amendment as amendment number? What number is this? Let's see. This is going to be amendment to the Y version, so this will be amendment number 1 to the Y version. Okay.
Okay. Okay. This is F7 up at the top right.
That's correct. On the top right-hand side on the corner. It's labeled as 24GH1048F7.
Okay. Oh, that's not.
And it should Yeah, on the very top right hand. It should be the top page on your packet, the very first page in your packet.
Okay. I would offer, and this, what number is this? Number
this is
one.
Number one.
Okay. I would offer amendment number one, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and I'll object for discussion.
This amendment is... thank you. Okay. This amendment simply amends page 9, line 1 of the bill. And we did this to the F version because we didn't have the Y version at the time.
Same
to section 16 currently permits the director to approve a voting machine or vote tally system for an election in the state upon consideration of factors that are promulgated by the Federal Election Commission under federal law, the HAVA, Help America Vote Act. And this specifically tracks the new law that we passed, Chapter 154 of last year, that requires that the director shall provide a paper record for each electronically generated ballot. And you can see the second page of this little packet sets forth the statute that we're referencing. Dr. Sonneman, who's in the office, in the audience there, had pointed out that originally the bill didn't require that, and so we're inserting that here. I understand the department has no objection.
We'll find out. Laura, does the department have any objection to this?
Mr. Amendment? Chairman, all I'd say is that it does say, the current law does say, the director shall provide for a paper record of each electronically generated ballot that can be reviewed and corrected by, so shall is in the current law. I don't know whether this is duplicative, but, you know, we're going to follow this law, so I don't know whether we need it, but I can follow it, because I'm going to follow the current law, which says shall.
Okay, so for clarification, then, the current law says that you shall provide a paper ballot. The only thing that this would do is say that you could not approve a voting machine
that did not have
the ballot. So clarification purposes, doesn't bother the department at all. Okay. Is there any other discussion on amendment number one? Representative Gatto.
Just a question. If you have a touch screen,
yes, sir,
does that generate a paper ballot?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, the current version that the state owns, there is not an attachment that provides a voter verified paper receipt. There is one currently in development that's being tested and approved by NASET and FEC and EAC, and those will be, before they go in the field, as directed by the law, current law, they will have a paper receipt. It's not a ballot.
I know, yeah, some paper trail.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and that provide for a non-electronic recount is the basically the purpose of that. So that's possible if we need a recount non-paper, non-electronic. Is there any other discussion on the bill? I'll remove my objection. Amendment number one then passes and is adopted. Okay, we now have Representative Grunberg, we have amendment number two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the F4 in the upper right-hand corner, and I would move amendment number two.
And I'll object for discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This authorizes the Division of Elections to establish a voting procedure using electronically generated ballots for one or more languages other than English. And this is quite important in a number of areas of the state, including in my district, where a number of people are Hispanic, Spanish speaking, in a number of other areas where there are folks who speak a number of different languages. And the division is already planning to do this. And this simply authorizes them to do that. and this will help get out the vote to a lot of people in the state.
Okay, and for clarification, it says that the ballots, the director shall provide ballots in English and may provide ballots in one or more additional languages. So this is not a requirement for all different languages, as I understand it. Ms. Glazer, would you let us know what the division's opinion on this is?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. That is correct. It does say may. So the director may provide alternative ballot languages. We are required by the federal law to currently translate into Tagalog for two precincts in Kodiak right now. So the division is currently doing that. Right now, we would attach no fiscal note because it says may. But should we have to do that, there will be a fiscal note because we're going to have to hire translators and the program needs to be set. If we do the ballot in audio, which was an original discussion on a pilot project to maybe do it in Yupik or a native language, we would do that translation. The ballot would appear before you in English, but the audio would be in their native language because they have no written language. So that's where we were first going to go.
And
that was our first bridge.
Representative Laura, do you see this in any way diminishing your capacity to do that in audio?
No, okay. Mr. Chairman.
And do you, does the division see any problems with having this amendment in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, not a problem at all. The point is that, you know, there will be candidates and pressure to translate into other languages, and there will be an increased cost to do that. We aren't currently mandated by federal law to do that. If we decide to go this extra step, it will be an increased cost. In our state, we don't have translators that are licensed, so there are going to be those concerns, but you know, it's workable, but there will be, you know, a cost to the state to do this.
I guess if the division has the authority to do it now, I mean, is there any difference between the division's deciding to offer ballots in another language or audio than if this language is in there and somebody requesting you to decide to do it or not to do it?
Mr. Chairman, no, there is not. All I'm just letting you know, as you just all voted on a supplemental for the Division of Elections, that there will be additional costs. But you are correct. Right now, the current law would allow the division to make that decision to work on a pilot project, which is what the Lieutenant Governor had discussed. So there is no difference. It's just that I feel obligated to let you know that there will be an increased cost should we go through this process.
Sure, and with this language here, if somebody would apply and say, we want to have this in Spanish, or we want it in Yupik, or we want it in something, is there a burden on the director to necessarily approve those? I mean, does the division think that there's a legal consequence if this language is in there that you would almost need to do that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer, and I would have to talk to Department of Justice whether it puts the state, you know, in that kind of bind or obligation, and then when you do that, does it stretch? If you choose to do it, say for instance in Spanish, then you know, what about the Chinese? What about the different dialects from the Philippines? You know, where does it end? But again, we could do this under current law. We could still engage in a pilot project to test, you know, interest, and then again, it's a policy call by the legislature if that's an investment that the state wants to make in translating the ballots in other languages.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Gatto, and then Gardner.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Boy, this sounds like the law of unintended consequences spinning off into the cosmos. How many dialects are in the Anchorage School District? And I don't know if you'd know that, but I heard it's 70, 80, 90 different dialects.
Could easily be.
There is no way that you could print 70, 80, 90 languages, all separate. You'd need, for each person, not even knowing how many people are coming to the polls, in every single one of those languages, just for that community. This scares me that we would ask. And I know it only says May, but I'm always suspicious of maybe someone requiring it later because you're allowed to do it, I think you should do it type of thing. And I'm very uncomfortable with this amendment, if I might add.
Representative Gardner?
Well, I have concerns, thank you, Mr. Chair, along the same lines. I mean, obviously, as a community, we want to encourage people to vote, as many people as possible, but what would the threshold be? How would people request it? You indicated that by federal law, we're required to provide ballots in Tagalog, in Kodiak, did you say? When do you need to have a request to do that, and why just that language? Is it specifically mandated, or is there some numbers that you meet?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, the federal law has a threshold, a standard, a percentage of the population of a certain community, and then you're required to translate. In California, they translate in Spanish, in Chinese, in one of the Philippine, I don't know whether they've chosen Tagalog, but there are different areas, and it's done when the census is done, and Department of Justice comes in, and prior to this administration, Department of Justice paid a visit to the state of Alaska and said, you have that population of Filipinos in Kodiak, and you will translate the ballots and all of our voting posters, and they actually came in and monitored the division this year to see that our training was complete, that our poll workers could explain, if you couldn't speak English, how to get help, which one of the poll workers mm-hmm. could assist them. So that's through a federal mandate, and that percentage of population only exists in those precincts in Kodiak. Nobody else has reached that threshold. And then in the same federal law, the Alaska Native languages or the Alaska Natives were excluded because they did not have written translation for the ballot. So the state is not under the same, doesn't have the same threshold to meet to reach out to the Native community.
So if we wanted in follow up to match the federal law, we could simply do something comparable but define it so that it could be an auditory ballot, as you suggested we could do for Native languages that don't have a written form.
Representative Gardner, through the chair, I'm not sure what you're saying, but are you saying that we the state still do that which we're required by the federal government
mm-hmm.
and then only do an audible ballot for those Native languages where there's not written translation?
Exactly. Well, it seems to me if we're doing it for immigrants to this country or to this state, that we should at least offer the same or comparable services for indigenous people, Native people, who have a different first language.
And Representative Gardner, through the chair, again, we can still do that. This was just, a further clarification because it is May and the division can do that now. And the Lieutenant Governor has discussed that idea of doing a pilot project in one of the Alaska Native languages to see the interest and to allow someone to vote. Because in the same case, Representative Kapsner brought up that they can't vote without assistance either. Many of them have to go find an elder or are an elder that needs a younger member of the community to help them make the translation of the ballot so that they can cast their vote.
Thank you.
Laura, I'm going to see if we can ask you to get a legal opinion as to whether this, if we pass this would put the state at
okay.
risk of having this balancing test, or you know what I mean, we're talking about this, mm-hmm. so rather than get into exact clarification. So I would like to hold this amendment and move on to the next, so if that's acceptable to the sponsor of the amendment.
It is.
We'll put this one on hold.
We'll table it.
Table it, yep.
But we do plan to bring it off the table at the next time.
You may bring it off the table at any time.
Okay, I'm just noticing it.
but we've got enough questions on this that we're going to find out.
Right.
Okay. Let me go back. I'm seeing enough people here that are maybe ready to vote on this without knowing.
I'll call the question.
That's fine with me. So we'll go back. We'll pull it off the table and bring it up.
That's fine.
Okay. So we have the amendment before us. Will you call the roll, please?
Representative Grunberg?
Yes.
Representative Gatto?
Pass.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Representative Ramirez?
No.
Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Representative Gatto?
No.
Chair Seaton?
No.
2 yay, 5 nay.
So amendment number 2 has failed. Okay, we are now on amendment number 3, and this is Representative Grunberg. This is power of attorney.
Yes, this is the F3, Mr. Chair.
In the upper right corner, F3 is.
And it's a long amendment, but it's very simple. It just allows the use of a general power of attorney as opposed to the very specific power of attorney. Because normally a general power of attorney allows the holder of the power to do anything that the maker of the power of attorney allows. The only reason it's a fairly lengthy amendment is because in Title 13 it set out a statutory form power of attorney, and under the bill drafting manual, the only change is on page 2, line 25, to perform the functions, the voting, which isn't voting itself, but it is defined on page 4, line 21 to 26, which allows the person holding the power to register the principal to vote, request an absentee ballot, or perform any other act relating to voter registration or voting the principal, is authorized to delegate to an agent specifically. And this is, again, the only thing this does is allow the use of a general power of attorney.
Representative Grunberg, would you, I'll object for discussion, would you point out to us again where that definition of voting?
Sure, it's on page 2, lines, excuse me, it's not page 2, it's section 2, page 4, lines 21 to 26, excuse me. Oh, I was referring to the amendment.
Okay, on the amendment line, what?
Okay, the reference in this statutory form is on page 2, the one word voting. Once again, that's a statutory form that's in the probate code. And it is defined in section 2 of the amendment on page 4, lines 22 to 26.
Thank you. Representative Gardner, any question?
To the sponsor of this amendment, do I understand correctly that this would allow somebody to vote for someone if they have a power?
No. The only way that could occur, if you would look on page 4, lines 25 and 26, mm-hmm. That would be somebody to physically do it if the person were incapacitated and directing the person, as I understand it. Ms. Glazer can correct me if I'm wrong.
We'll get the department in a second. So, Laura, would you give us your take on this?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair. Again, not being an attorney, I would we do allow that in special needs voting for someone to assist someone who is incapacitated, with the ballot. And all I would say is voting the right word on page 2 of the amendment, line 25? Is there something so that it doesn't lead someone to believe that they can vote, that they could actually, if they have the power of attorney, could vote for somebody else? Because would they have this statute available to them at the same time. I'm sorry that I'm not personally...
The intent there through the chair was to mark the ballot at the direction of the person, mm-hmm. and I certainly would have no objection putting that in if you wanted. That was certainly the intent.
Okay, because looking at it, to me, it means that somebody could delegate that authority to...
Well, why don't we just, Mr. Chair, I'll make an amendment to the amendment then.
Okay,
on page four.
Before we do that, I think part of the confusion is on page 2, line 25, where we're inserting the word just voting. Is that because I think that this is going to be what people are seeing is voting here. And so if in your amendment there's another word or description voting related acts, something other than just saying voting, because the someone getting a general power of attorney that says voting on it, the clear reading of that is for us people that aren't lawyers and don't have the statute that has section 2 in it, we're going to assume that that's what you're delegating.
So, Mr. Chair, let me make a suggestion. Let us table this amendment. We're about out of time today. We can pass on to the next one if there is time, and then I can come back.
We would take a motion to table this.
Okay,
yeah,
I'll
we will
do
table.
That.
Okay.
We'll work on this. I have.
I think that way. People agree the concept is good. The wording needs to be clarified.
We will do that.
I mean, that's what I'm seeing from the committee is that there's general agreement that
something more like complete the ballot,
well,
complete
voting,
the ballot at the direction
yeah,
of or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Something. Yes. Okay. Should we pass on? Do we have time to start the next one?
Yes, we do.
Okay. The next one I'll offer is number 4, and this is G3 in the upper right. And if the members who were on the committee last year will recall that the committee worked hard on this section of the bill, and we indicated that the director was required to give full public notice if there's a new precinct that's established or abolished, or if the boundaries are changed, or if the location of the polling place is changed. And we worked hard on that section, and when the bill came back before us this year, the language that we had put in this section was not there, and instead it went back to the original version that was offered last time by the Division of Elections. And this simply reinserts all the work that the committee did last year. And very specifically, Mr. Chair, we indicated that the public notice must send written notice of the change to each affected registered voter. That's on lines 8 and 9 of the amendment. Had to publish 3 times in a local newspaper and post in 3 conspicuous places. And also, down at the bottom of the amendment, notify not just the municipal clerks, but community councils, tribal groups, presiding officers, native villages, and regional corporations under ANCSCA. And this exactly tracks what we did in committee. And it really ensures that the public knows if there's been any change in where they vote or the boundaries.
And Laura, do you have comments for the division? Please?
Well, Mr. Chair, obviously the division offered the language the way they wanted it, and this is, you know, it's again the legislature's decision. On the notice, I would just say that it says in published 3 times in a local paper, and the language that we had said that on 3 different days in a current paper. So, if the way this is written, does that mean that we could put 3 ads in the same paper? I think that the way it was drafted, the intent was to communicate that on 3 different days you would see the same language before you. And that, again, I'll just say for the record one more time, that the posting of notices in 3 conspicuous places we had offered that it be one conspicuous place, again, because in many of the areas, it's difficult to find three conspicuous places. Are people really looking on the note boards? In some of the small communities, there is a place where they gather, and one is usually sufficient. We have increased the adding that it'll be posted on our website. And this amendment actually requires us to send a written notice directly to each voter. You know, is it a point that we're over-notifying? Again, a policy call of the division of the legislature, and the division will do what we need to do. The fiscal note's approximately $20,000 on this. Again, increased mailing and notice costs, and that was before you last year as well.
Representative Grunberg.
Yes. With respect to the three times, it was certainly, I think, the intent of the committee, and you folks who were on it last time can correct me if I'm wrong, that it would be on three different days. And so that can easily be cured. And I will offer an amendment to change three times to three different days. May I make that amendment here?
Yeah. We have an amendment to from three times to three.
That's on line 11.
Different days?
Yes.
Any objection to that amendment? Seeing no objection, that's adopted.
May I continue?
Yes, Representative Grunberg.
With respect to the three conspicuous places, we talked about this at some length last year, and I think it was the feeling that there should be three places to post in every precinct. And the folks who live locally, even if most people saw it on a bulletin board someplace, the local election officials would know other locations. This may be a slight over-notification, but, you know, people, I think, may observe something but not fully register. And they have to see it several times, and this would just make it a little more certain that they saw it. And that was also the feeling, frankly, about the sending written notice. But that's why we, I think, as a committee, decided to do that last time. If you folks can correct me if I'm misstating what we did. So I'm not going to offer to change that.
That was too long ago for me. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Laura, the $20,000 fiscal note, which part of it is the expensive part? Notifying individual voters or running newspaper ads and posting in a conspicuous place?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, the posting in the conspicuous place is not any different than current law, so that's not reflected in the fiscal note, so I'll work backwards. The mailing, certainly, mailing to every voter, is going to increase additionally three times in the paper. We looked at the costs, and that'll be reflected when we finally do the fiscal note, should the amendment pass, of how many precinct boundary changes that we implemented last year at the division and what the costs were. So it would be outlined for you in the fiscal note, but that's our best estimate on the amendment.
Okay, and in follow-up.
Okay, Representative Gardner, I'm afraid we're out of time. And unfortunately, we're going to hold this amendment as well. Representative Vigato has an announcement.
I have an announcement specifically to Representatives Grunberg, Gardner, and Seaton, that and to the public in general, that we have a subcommittee meeting today regarding House Bill 114, Parental Rights. That'll be right here at 2 o'clock, lasting about an hour.
My apologies to everybody that the meeting went so long here, and that, Laura, we didn't get all the way through. We did have a number of people online. We are working on this in committee. We've had public hearing before. When we get along, we may, depending upon our time frame, open for comments from the public again, because this is an extremely important piece of legislation. There's nothing more important than voting and how how we conduct that action in the state. But we will have to get through our amendments and everything before we have testimony from the public. So if the public wishes to get to the committee members and let us know what's happening, email myself as chairman of the committee, and we will make sure those get distributed in writing, and we will be adjourned at 10:05.